Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Parkscope Unprofessional Podcast Hour. My name is Joe. Joining me tonight is Nick. Nick, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing very well, Joe. Very well.
Very well.
6 more days with kids. I just got back from Orlando. You can't beat that.
Yeah, that's not bad. You did. How was cowfish, by the way? Real quick review.
Delicious. No complaints. I mean, it's phenomenal food. I had a bison chipotle burger, so it was like bison meat with the chipotle sauce mixed into it, so it had like a little kick to it. It phenomenal. Just an outstanding burger.
You're the one who pronounces chipotle wrong, so.
Whatever. I'm from the South. We pronounce everything wrong.
That's true. And you also, you call pop wrong, too. So
that pop is the little rocks that you eat as candy.
Okay.
Or music.
Okay.
We don't have pop that you drink like you.
Yes, I love my pop. Anyway, also joining us tonight on this very special podcast, and I'm extremely excited, it is Sam Genoway. He is a urban planner, designer, author of the Disneyland Story, and also of Universal versus Disney. I always get the subtitle of the book wrong.
Me too.
Yeah, America's Greatest Theme Park Rivalry or something like that. The unofficial story of America's theme park greatest rivalry or something like that.
I like to just call it Universal versus Disney. The unofficial guide makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, there we go.
Make sure that whatever you're searching for on the internet, it should theoretically pop up. Hi, I'm Sam. Glad to be here.
Yes, nice to meet you, Sam.
What's pop? Is pop like soda or something like that?
Yes, pop is soda in the Midwest.
Oh,
basically,
okay.
If you're from like Michigan or Ohio, it's pop.
And what do you call it in Savannah?
Coke.
Yeah, that's
it's
true.
All Coke.
That's true. Good point. No, red, white, blue. All right. Well, I'm glad to be here, guys. Thanks.
Yes, thank you for joining us. As you guys may or may not know, Sam released the new book, Universal versus Disney, The Unofficial Guide, on December 2nd. You can find that from all major retailers. I bought it off of Kindle because I wanted it as soon as possible so I could actually read this book quickly. Because we're doing an interview in a little over a week. So, yes, go find this book, read it, come back, listen to the podcast, or just listen. I don't care. Do whatever you want. So, Sam, just let's start real quick. Kind of like, what's your background and how'd you kind of start with the theme park business and your interests in it?
By daytime, I'm an urban planner. I work with communities, generally public sector agencies, working on large infrastructure projects. And I do the sort of strategic communications and working with the communities to bring them along. And that, of course, being a guy who grew up in Southern California, used to go to Disneyland, had that seeped into my brain both on a personal and professional level. So that's what got me interested, I believe, in Disneyland. And it's really impacted my work because if you think about it, you can't go to a central business district anymore without it looking really clean and historic buildings being revitalized and very walkable and good signage and extra police and all that kind of stuff. Those are direct outgrowths of Disneyland, and the fact that a lot of my brethren make environmental impact reports, that's an outgrowth of Walt Disney's developments, and then the dream of the city of Epcot. So that's what I do during the day, and then I was really fascinated about Walt Disney's interest in environmental design, and that's what was the first book, which is called Walt Disney and the Promise of Progress City, which is being re-released on Theme Park Press, so that should be out maybe by the time this podcast goes up. So that's the first book. And then that led to doing two additional books, which was the Disneyland Story, which as a guy who growing up in Southern California, it's really a biography of Disneyland. I just was really fascinated about the way things have changed and how little originally was there. And then if you're going to do that, I started looking north to Universal City and what was going on up there and started doing a lot of research and recognized that really nobody else had written much about like the history of the tour and the parks. And it seemed like an interesting story, and it sure was.
Yeah, there really is. There seems to be a lot written about the start of Disneyland, and your book on the start of Disneyland is just like stepping stone number one. It is a fantastic resource, but you know, there are a lot of other, you know, articles, I would say, on the internet. I don't know what else to say.
I'm Disney has been Disney, and especially the Disney fans. And I give the credit to the Disney fans. In fact, I was fortunate to host a talk up at the Walt Disney Family Museum in San Francisco on the topic. Cool. Which was about how it was called Disneyland, the fan-driven time machine. And it was myself and Werner Weiss from Yesterland and Jeff Curdy and Todd Pierce, who's a great academic. And the idea was that it was one of the few places in America where the visitor fell in love with it so much and embraced it. And then kind of it started with merchandise, but then it turned out to what's the history behind this merchandise with the e-ticket magazine. Mm-hmm. And the fans started preserving the history of this place. And the company kind of caught up with that and realized there was actually a history in its heritage. Universal never had that because, you know, what are we up to? About the 18th owner of the company right now. And every time one comes about, they obliterate the one that was there before. So Universal never really cared about its heritage, I don't believe. And that's kind of part of the secret magic of Universal. And so it's a very, very different story. It's a very Hollywood story is what it turned out to be.
Yeah, that actually, before we go into Universal, that's a really good point. I think it's really interesting to say, like, you know, people kind of grew up with Disney with Uncle Walt. And mm-hmm. kind of embrace that history more. And, you know, with Werner Weiss and all those people, it's really interesting to see how, kind of like how they've created the Yesteryear Land and all those creations. Like, even now you can still go back to all the Al Lutz posts from when back when, you know, it's like Light Magic is going to debut next week, you know, and you can see this. And it's a very interesting collection, but Universal does not have that at all. You barely can find a video of, like, the first year's fireworks at Islands Adventure, but you can get a complete history and story of Light Magic.
Yeah, that's true. That's very, very true. So, I think once again, it's a case of in Los Angeles, Universal Studios tour for local residents was a fairly secondary attraction. It was really a place you only went when you had out of town relatives and you didn't want to take them to the real Hollywood because the real Hollywood was scary. in Florida, you know, it took a long time for Universal Studios Hollywood to kind of or Florida to sink in, and Islands of Adventure was beautiful, but through marketing mishaps, it took a long time for people to discover it. And now that they're discovering it, I think that there's a real interest of how did we get here, especially because so little, not so much Islands of Adventure, but boy, at Universal Studios Florida, there's so little that was there. You know, it's a completely whole new park. And if you've come to Hollywood lately, you'll see the same thing there. The entire hilltop, literally, there is nothing left on the hilltop that was there when they created the hilltop area in 1965. So it's amazing.
That's really fantastic. So I guess let's get in the book. We kind of talked about the germination of the project a little bit.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about a little about the research period, anything interesting that popped up with interviews or kind of surprises that you've noticed, like kind of when you're finding stuff?
This was kind of different than the Disneyland book, because in the Disneyland book, of course, many of the creators weren't alive, and so there was the typical go through archives and written documents and all that kind of stuff that I had to do. And there was fortunate, you know, people like Bob Gurr and Rolly Crump and Marty Sklar and others gave me their time. But in the case of Universal, the project was relatively recent, and I had because of the success of the Disneyland book, it opened up doors that were just remarkable. So on documentation, there was the Harrison Buzz Price Files, who is the guy who literally did the study that found where Disneyland and Walt Disney World should be. And he worked also for MCA, worked for Universal as well, and did studies mm-hmm. for them. And in fact, I would dare say that Harrison Buzz Price really created the Universal Studios tour in 1961 when he did a feasibility study, and he outlined all the things they needed to do and then helped find Barry Upson, who was gracious and gave me a lot of his time as the very first general manager who implemented what it is that Buzz had come up with. Albert Dorskin was no longer alive, but he had donated a whole bunch of files to the Huntington Library which I do research at. And the guy who got the stuff said, Sam, you know, we got these like four boxes. We haven't gone through them yet, but you're the one that's interested in this right now. So here, have fun. Go through them. And it's all the earliest history of the when buying Universal's property and the pitch to do the hotels in Yosemite, which MCA did do, or the tram tour that they ran in Washington, D.C. Yes, they did these sort of things. Or their attempt to do the Cape Canaveral Space Center and be the tour guides for that. So these kinds of studies. And then I one snowed onto the other. Bob Gurr introduced me to who's the guy who did the Utopian monorail, also built the King Kong head, who then introduced me to Peter Alexander. And Peter Alexander was the guy who was the principal designer of Universal Studios Florida and the guy who designed many of the attractions. And then I talked to Terry Winnick and Phil Hedema, who wrote the foreword of the book, Gary Goddard, who designed Conan and the Terminator 2 show, and on and on and on. The guys who were there, Barry Upson, the guys who were there at the very beginning, were gracious enough to give me their time because I think many of them wanted to get the stories out. They're really proud of their work and stuff, and so that was great. It was a really rewarding experience.
Absolutely incredible, the kind of people you met so far. I honestly, I'm only 70% through the book, so I'm still reading it. But
that's great.
it's absolutely fantastic. Actually, something that reminded me when you were talking about the feasibility studies was, and also part of the reason why I don't think the parks were as well represented, is it was something like 60 to 40% tourists to locals, or 70 to 30% tourists to locals, or something like that. So it didn't seem like...
Oh, you're saying like for Universal Studios Hollywood?
Yes, I'm sorry, yes.
Oh, in its early, oh no, no, it's in its early days. It was like well over 80% tourists. It was not a local's favorite. If you were a local in Southern California, you had a lot of other options. You were either going to Disneyland, you were going to Knott's Berry Farm, Japanese Deer Park, Busch Gardens, which was another industrial tour, except for it was cheaper and it gave free beer at the end of it.
We fully approve.
You had a lot of other things, and you had the beaches and the parks and the mountains and stuff in Southern California. Universal knew very early on what they were creating was something that was very dependent on us out-of-towners, which is why they kept playing around with the concept of different sort of shopping malls, or the Universal Amphitheater was a big part of bringing locals. And so in Universal's case, it was really quite intriguing. Their idea was, I'm going to bring out-of-town guests during the day, and then at night, we're going to bring all the locals to come up to watch, well, when they did the movie theaters or City Walk or the Universal Amphitheater, and then a couple of other tries for what was going to be a series of concert halls up on the hill there and stuff like that, and a variety of different types of shopping malls that they had looked at. So it's a very, very different kind of place. It had a real different mix, and that actually was by design. They didn't ever really want to be Disneyland. They did think about it for a few minutes. They did want to be the Tivoli Gardens of the San Fernando Valley. and they did a whole design and had architectural team come up with something that would have had sort of like little themed lands around a lagoon. But that went away fairly quickly.
Interesting. And I remember reading your part on CityWalk at Universal Studios Hollywood, that really kind of balanced out the tourism in that area, where more locals were coming to like almost a 50-50 split for the tram tour once they opened CityWalk.
Yeah, and it really helped. It helped with the tram tour quite a bit because it was more convenient to locals. And you had this real dynamic that had a destination attraction in the Universal Studios that was unique. You had City Walk, which was a vibrantly designed, unusual shopping center, really unlike anything before. Quite honestly, because it's such an aggravating environment at times, I don't think anybody else has ever built one like that again either. Everybody else has sort of gone back to the Disneyland Main Street reassurance model instead of the "we're gonna be in your face" of City Walk. You had the largest multiplex theater in the United States at the time up there. You had the world's famous Universal Amphitheater, really one of the most dynamic pop music concert halls in the country, whether indoor or outdoors. You had this whole variety of destinations, and then you had a really honest-to-God working movie studio, which in Universal's earliest days, 64, 65, 66, Keep in mind, there were three television networks. MCA was producing 16 to 17 hours of primetime television. When you were on the tram tour for the first couple of years, you were going to see, unless you were there on Saturday, you were going to see somebody filming something. There was always action on the lot. So that was an amazing time.
Let's transition a little bit from there. Kind of the creation of the Hollywood tour, along with its eventual, MCA losing a lot of its, primetime television or moving movie production off the lot. So moving away from, you can see all these hours of production to hear special effects.
Yeah, the one notion with MCA, who's really the one who created the tour, Music Corporation of America, that ended up buying Universal, was this was all about money. So the tour really was about really raising revenues in the commissary, the studio commissary. Yeah, really, the studio commissary was hemorrhaging. They had Universal was producing all these massive television shows through review productions. They needed land to do as back lot for the TV show, so they had. They bought the land of Universal, and then ultimately they bought Decca, which gave them Universal Studios the intellectual properties. So this guy Albert Dorskin, he's the money guy. He's the guy who's in charge of the property, the real estate guy. And he notices that the commissary is losing like $100,000 a year, and he thinks, all right, that's not good. And then he's going into Farmers Market here in Los Angeles, and he's noticing tour buses are letting people off to go have lunch, and then they get back on, and then they go drive around L.A. So he made a deal with a tour bus company that for a buck ahead, they could drive around the back lot and then just drive right off. And before they left, they drop everybody off at the commissary in the off hours. And they raised the prices of the commissary, and all of a sudden Universal is making a whole bunch of money out of its commissary. And then he goes, you know what? If this is working so well, maybe we should do this full time, get rid of the other buses. And that's how the tour was born. So it was to raise money for the commissary. So for the first few years, you're right, it was going through and you could see production. In 1968, SAG had put in a requirement that really started to restrict visitor access to the sound stages, because prior to that, the tour guides really were the kings and queens of the tour, and they could go in any studio that wasn't filming at that time. So if, Marcus Welby was on break, they could go in and walk around the Marcus Welby studio. So between SAG rules, diminishing production of television, more on-location shooting, things started to lessen up in the back lot. But they predicted this in 1961. One of the things they had to do is to create some sort of special effects and demonstrations so that if you happen to go on the weekend, you at least have the same kind of fun experience you might have had during the week. So the first one of those was a leftover from the television show Wagon Train, which was the flood scene, the flash flood scene. And that was it just happened to be an old TV lot set that was used, and Barry Upson went, oh, well, that'll work. Let's just drive through there. And really for the first, first few weeks, it didn't work whatsoever, and it would drown the trams and stuff like that. But that's, amazingly enough, it's still there. The second one was the tram would pull up, and most of these were done by the studio technicians at first. So, they were designed like special effects. They worked well for that one shot, and then they would break. So the second one was, which is, I've only seen one photo of it, they would pull up and then the driver would push a garage door button, which would release an ape hanging from a chain going down like a little zip line that would go right across the tram. So people would think like a monkey was flying past them. And it didn't work all the time. And when it did work, they would put clothes on or, bathing suits or trunks or stuff like that on the monkey. And that was like the second one. And then they started figuring out, we've got to start doing this for real. Terry Winnick, who was one of the earliest tour guides, who happened to be learning architecture, got pointed out by Jay Stein, who was taking over the parks, and saying, you, I want you. And he started coming up with things like the collapsing bridge and rock slide, where a bunch of little foam boulders came and rolled over you, and all those kind of fun stuff.
Yeah, I remember the foam boulder one quite a lot, because I was reading this on, I forget what website it was, but they collected a lot of water, and it never worked.
Oh, yeah.
So,
oh, Yeah, they were. It was quite a machine. There was an elevator company that Terry Winnick worked with, and they were little foam things. And what would happen is they would roll down the hill, and then when they got to the bottom, they would sort of hit a lip so that they popped up. So that looks, ooh, they're going to run over us. And then they would fall in a trench, and then the trench, they would get smashed and then folded and pushed back up the hill by a little lift. And then they'd get up at the top trough, and they'd pop open again and then roll back down. And they didn't last very long because they're getting squished and popped and squished and popped. And then if it was wet at all, they would sort of pick up water, and they would just go and then hit the little lip and not get enough lift and just go slamming into the tram. You're boom with a little thing. So that was an early one. But then things like the collapsing bridge were pretty dependable, and Terry Winnick came up with Jaws and a few others that were really quite dependable, and they kind of defined the franchise.
And there was also the funny one of the Moses parting in the water, and how that was time based and not location based.
Oh yeah, I always wondered about that too. First of all, it was a Paramount film; it wasn't even a Universal film, so that was one thing that always kind of got me. But yeah, used to, you know, the little tram would go over it and it would pick up, and the trams then were much smaller, so really everybody in the tram could see it. And if you even kind of see that today, the roadway was designed so everybody would be able to see the effect of the water. But they would go and they would push a button, and then the water would go down, and they'd have only so much time to get across. And if they did, then the water would start filling up again. So if you've ever seen the movie The Naked Bomb, the Get Smart film of The Naked Bomb, they do show people jumping into the lake on the old trams.
Oh, interesting. That's pretty great. And also right now, the lake area with the trams is where they have the Kong kind of set.
Oh, it just sucks. It's just, you know, it's really nothing. They go by it, and they don't even, they used to talk about the little water tank of, oh, we used to have, you know, these people in it. And the water tank really had a better story. It's where they filmed the little military miniatures during the earlier days. Mm-hmm. And then you would turn a corner, and they would talk about the park that they used for Apollo 13. And now they just go, McHale's Navy, and then you go by what they call a bigature, which is the model, which wasn't originally out there. It's because the tram goes below right at the water's edge, it makes that effect work. But it's not like they filmed that in that spot. That was filmed in someplace else.
Yeah,
they just moved it there. So the whole thing is sort of it's nothing. They don't even, the last few times I've been on the tour, they don't even open it and close it anymore. It's just a trough, and you just drive through the trough.
Yeah, they decommissioned it, so it's just a trough now. So you don't even get that. Okay,
It's sad.
Yeah.
But let's talk about something happier. What's the next question?
Yeah, happy. do you want to talk a little bit about Jaws or any of the other editions, Battlestar Galactica, anything while we're still at Hollywood?
Sure. Jaws was great. Jaws was the idea was pretty clever. Jay Stein, who is really running the parks, and Jay Stein really is the guy who defined what the Universal Studios experience was. He was the guy, and we'll get into it with Florida. He is the mm-hmm. whole reason why there is the resort in Florida. He was at one point worked at the studio as the guy who was in charge of scheduling all of the sound stages in the back lot. And so with that knowledge, he knew all of the different directors and producers, because they had to come to him to schedule, I need, you know, stage 25, or I need this, the old European set or something like that. So he knew all the creative talent, and he really knew the process of putting together movies. And so he had a deep understanding, and he had a real passion to want to display that and show that off to the general public and stuff. So he knew the productions that were coming up, and he heard about Jaws, and he was watching for it, and he knew that there was going to be something great. So he hired Bob Matty, who did the original mechanical Jaws, the shark for the movie, and he hired Bob Matty to basically take the original mechanical shark and then just rebuild it and put it at the theme park. Put it on the tour, and Bob Matty did that. Now, it didn't work very well at the beginning, because once again, you've got a guy who, well, he did end up doing all the animals for the Jungle Cruise at Disneyland, and the shark for, or the the giant squid from 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, but the shark was as fabled for breaking down on the tour as it was in the movie itself. Terry Winnick came in and then rebuilt the thing in a way that allowed it to operate on a pretty dependable level. And shark has gone through, and the whole set's gone through different things. There used to be the Orca boat, used to be back there until it kind of decomposed and broke apart. They've had different victims. They have the whole fire effect now that came about much later on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's always a lot of fun. The shark himself has changed a little bit. He used to have teeth that looked more like the movie poster, which had gigantic carrot-like teeth. They called him Carrot Face. but the essence of it, which is you go down and a big giant mechanical shark attacks you, and then more importantly, as you leave the area, the set resets. It's a reminder that you're seeing a little peek of backstage Hollywood, and that's a Jay Stein thing. They called them J-Bangs, and what Jay thought people wanted was that moment when you're really scared and then you start to laugh nervously. That's the whole premise of every ride, the Ride the Movie ride that's at Universal, is to get you to go, ah! and that is called a J-Bang, named after Jay Stein, and that was literally, if you were coming up with a ride or a show, on the front page of your prospectus, you wrote what the J-Bangs were, and you had to have a couple of them, and he would rank them on a scale of 1 to 10, and if you had a 10, you would get the green light to move along with your program. And so that was Jaws. Now, Battlestar Galactica was really a breakthrough it in many ways. It was the largest use of real lasers in a show. It had a real live actor. It had the robots that talked to you. You basically rode the movie or rode the television show in this case. You're driving along in the tram, and all of a sudden the guardians stop you, and they sit there and they say, oh, we're going to take you. You've seen too much. And then the guard's like, no, the tram tour guide's going, no, you can't. Oh, yes, you can take us. And then you're ushered into the show building. You go through this wonderful little light show with lasers that had never really been used this way before. Some of those most powerful lasers in the basement kind of reflected all over the place. Smoke, the robots, the live actors. And then, and this was really different than anything else that existed at the time at Universal, when you left, you didn't see the show reset. You really did ride the movie. You went in, you experienced a moment in time, you were scared, you got your J-Bang, and then you left. You didn't see the shark resetting or any of the bridge resetting or any of that stuff. So in a sense, that was a real breakthrough and sort of foretold the future of the Universal parks where they are today, as their fantasy parks.
Really interesting. Nick, do you have any questions right now?
Not yet.
Not yet?
Yeah. I haven't read the book yet. I've been out of town. And then
what's wrong with you? Oh my God! You're letting life get in the way.
It's Joe's fault. Always it's Joe's fault.
No, it's not. It's not my fault. It's the fact that you're actually at Universal Orlando this weekend.
Yeah,
there you go. Oh, see, now when you read the book, though, you're going to look at that place all differently. I'm telling you that now.
See, that's really why. If I would have been home, I would have read it. So, and I've never been to Hollywood. So I've never been to Universal Studios Hollywood. So I don't really, you know, I know. But I don't know.
It's changing right now, yes. Okay. Yeah,
it is. Before we move on to Florida, real quick, something you put in your book was that RCA actually approached the Bass Brothers to take part in some sort of ownership deal with Universal Studios Florida for the park, and they were later the ones who were the White Knights for Disney. And also, MCA looked to buy Disney for $1.5 billion.
Yeah, yeah. And theoretically, Disney looked to buy MCA at one point as well, too. Michael Eisner was sniffing around. That's one of the sort of central premises of the book. When, you know, the way that I write this history stuff is that I don't know what the story is when I start. I have to just collect data. Mm-hmm. And as I collect the data and go through it, the storyline seems to rise. That's been the case in all three books. And it's one of the reasons why the one book turned into the Disneyland book was a biography, because that's the story that really needed to be told. Universal, if you ever see me at an event, you get it signed, I'm probably going to sign it, "Welcome to Hollywood, baby." because it really is. The story of Universal is Disney and Universal were really actually very supportive of each other in the early days. You know, if Walt could have figured out a way of showing how movies were made, he wouldn't have built Disneyland. He couldn't figure that out, so he figured, I'll just put people in the fantasy instead. But Buzz Price, a close friend of his, and a guy who worked with them on 150 projects, who also worked with Universal and did 60 projects with Universal Studios over the years, Walt liked the fact that his buddy, Dr. Jules Stein, who ran MCA, figured out how to make some money off the back lot and show people how movies were made. The first, one of the earliest general managers of Universal Studios Hollywood Tour was the first marketing director for Disneyland, Ed Edinger. So the companies were really pretty close with each other. They figure they're two different, completely different things. MCA, Disney, or Universal really tried very hard to never do anything quite like Disney. They didn't want to compete because they recognized, for instance, if you're doing a show like Disneyland or SeaWorld, for instance, the audience has an expectation of professionalism that keeps rising on every single visit. At Universal, they figured if they throw an average bloke into a show scene, you're very forgiven, so you don't have to spend a lot of money on the shows, and people still get the big bang for the buck. So you make a lot more money. They were making a lot of money off this tour in the early days. And so they were very much trying to not compete with each other. It really wasn't until some sort of dealings with Michael Eisner, Lou Wasserman, Sidney Sheinberg, and Jay Stein where everything in the world changed, and that's Hollywood, baby, because movie moguls like to fight with each other, and they use a lot of money to do it.
Yeah, the story you told in the book, and also from what I heard before, was that as part of Paramount, Michael Eisner saw the Universal Studios Florida project plans way early, like in the 80s, I believe, you're saying.
81, yeah.
Yeah, 81. Uh-huh. So that a decade before they would happen, back when it was still very much like a Universal Studios Hollywood project, but in Florida.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting. And also combined with then expanding the Great Movie Ride attraction in Epcot to a full park, and also one of my favorite quotes that can now be applied more than ever to Disney's Hollywood Studios, or Disney MGM it was then, was, quote-unquote, meant it could be less finished in its look than our other two parks.
Yeah, that is a quote by Michael Eisner, folks. That's not my commentary, but
yes.
Let's hear it for Eisner. I think he got that one right. It is an interesting story because, once again, they weren't wanting to compete with each other. Of course, Disney World started. Lou Wasserman, Jules Stein, they were friends with the Disneys, and they figured, well, if Disney's got their theme park going and stuff, that's good, and they'll watch it, and they were watching it, and they had Buzz Price do a study pretty much right after Orlando opened just to see what the real estate market, but they put it on a back burner. Jay Stein kept saying, if this thing really takes off and stuff, we should at least consider duplicating the facilities that we have here in Hollywood. We could do the same thing. We could build a studio. We could take advantage of non-union labor. Jay Stein was a studio guy. We could do a tour around it. It would be great. It'd be a nice compliment. It'd work out very much like what we have here in Southern California. And Lou Wasserman's like, yeah, I don't really want to do it, but I'll tell you what. If you can find about 400 acres in Florida, pretty cheap, you know what? If I believe in the Disney guys, if you can get 400 acres, it's going to be worth something sooner or later. We've got a lot of money right now. We've got the profits from Jaws, stuff like that. So let's go ahead. You find some cheap property out there. And the question I always ask is, well, why 400 acres? And the answer is, as Lou Wasserman told Jay Stein, look, I've got 400 acres in Los Angeles. I'm not using all of it. So what do I need more than 400 acres for in Florida? What are you going to do out there? It's not any bigger than what I got out here. So they did. They found a wonderful property, pretty cheap. It was already zoned as a shopping mall, so the issues as far as access and zoning and stuff like that was pretty well taken care of. So it was a really smart investment deal that MCA was making. And Lou Wasserman, once again, wasn't real excited about doing the theme park or another tour. So he basically said, you got to figure out one of two things. You've got to figure out what's the demand for studio space, if there's a lot, well, you know, it's going to help our primary business. So that's one thing. And what they discovered, there wasn't going to be much of a demand at all for movies. Even the whole Disney thing was overblown that way. There wasn't that much space for more than two sound stages in Central Florida for both studios, as far as what they figured out the demand. So the other thing was you have to figure out another way of getting a partner, because we're not going to spend all of our money. If this is such a good idea, you go find a partner. And that's what Jay Stein had to do. And he put together a very elaborate process to try to find a partner. And one of the first people they talked to was Michael Eisner, because he was the head of Paramount Studios. He was a good friend with Sidney Sheinberg, who was running the Universal Studios. And they put together a very elaborate show with multiple projectors and showed Eisner. And Eisner was very interested. Now, I have to stop. Michael Eisner does claim that he was never at the presentation. So it's entirely possible that he was not at the presentation that he was at, but I can't – all I can do is verify that he was at the presentation.
Besides, so, you know, all the notes and show and meeting notes and everything that, you know, like Michael Eisner was there, but we can't prove it 100%.
And meeting all the people who were giving the presentation, and so he heard the thing, and he was actually fairly interested. You know, it seemed to make sense. Paramount, Universal, he could get into this expanded business, but he was just the guy running Paramount. He didn't own it. That was Gulf and Western, and the Gulf and Western guy said, "Nah, don't do that." Universal went to everybody. I mean, they went to everybody in Hollywood trying to make a deal with somebody, and they just couldn't do it. When Eisner moved over to Disney in 84, Sidney Sheinberg called and figured, oh, the door's open. You know, Eisner liked what we were doing. It makes a lot of sense of Universal and Disney, because, you know, Disney could probably do a really good job with this. They just need a live action kind of catalog to make it happen, because there was no deal with MGM at the time. And Eisner just went, it sounds like, you know, we're working on something of our own. And then it ended. And that's when the MCA guys recognized that Eisner was going to try to preemptively build a studio tour based on the Hollywood model in Florida as a preemptive, so that Universal would just back away and sell off their property and not compete with them at all. But it didn't work that way, because as powerful as Michael Eisner was, Lou Wasserman, who ran MCA, was much more powerful. And he said, go ahead, spend $600 million of mine, build the theme park. And of course, he got Cineplex Odeon, Garth Dabrinsky as a partner, which was a guy that Lou Wasserman really admired. And that was the 50-50 partner. Now, the fact that the partner was also owned by MCA at the time is kind of interesting. But that's the primary reason why there is a theme park in Florida. And we can all attribute that to Jay Stein, who you guys probably know this, but for any of your readers who don't, if you're at the Gramercy Park section of the Universal Studios Florida, and that's the little New York section with the tall pillar in the middle that has the Archangel on the top. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yep, right. Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, like kind of on your way to watching the horrible roller coaster Twister, and then on your way to the month. Sorry. Yeah, you know.
No, it's a horrible roller coaster. We hate that thing. So.
Okay. Yeah, it's terrible.
The Mummy, on the other hand, I really, really like, especially because it's much better than the one here in California. But that statue that's on the top of it, if you look at the face very, very closely, that is Jay Stein. That is the tribute to him in the park, is that he's on the top as the Archangel. Lou Wasserman is on Lincoln's body at the end of New York Street with his signature glasses in his hand behind. They can remove his hat. I think a lot of people know that little tidbit.
That's right near Transformers.
That's right. And then the people that are on the windows throughout the park, for the most part, are real people, just like Disneyland's and Disney World's main streets. So those are real people who worked on the parks. Even the stars on the Hollywood Boulevard portion, the ones that face the wrong direction, are people who work for the parks. They have a little special parks emblem as well, too. So there's little tributes. Ups and Fish, I think, is what it is in the San Francisco section. That's named for Barry Upson. So who was fundamental in helping to design that park as well.
That's pretty awesome. You answered everything I had. Nick, you have anything right now?
Go
on, Nick.
Okay. What made them decide that, okay, since they saw that Disney was deciding to go with a a version of what was going on in Hollywood. What made them decide to kind of do this different version with not so much of the studio tour, more of the ride the movies thing, instead of kind of going with the whole tour backlot type experience?
It's because that's what Disney was going to do. And they recognized very early on that it was Bob Ward, Barry Upson, Peter Alexander were the principal designers of the Universal Studios Florida. They had always very, very small teams compared to Disney. There really is just a handful of people design their parks for the most part. And in this particular case, the sole and primary reason for building Universal Studios Florida was because Disney was going to build the Hollywood MGM studio. They recognized that they could never compete with Disney, that Disney was always going to somehow or other do a better job than them on this idea of the tour, because Disney had first the advantage of getting started a little faster, being able to entitle their property because they owned their own government. They could get anything built a lot faster than Universal would have been able to, because they had to deal with the city. And so they figured out, well, we can't go head to head because we're going to lose. So we got to go something different. And so the idea of those guys was, instead of taking the tram through the back lot, we'll let people walk through the studio and walk through the back lot and let them really go through a real back lot. So you walk through, and the premise is it's just like going to Universal Studios Hollywood, but this time, instead of going into a theme park entrance or a tour entrance, you're really going through the front gate of the studio, and you're going through the administrative offices of the studio. And then you go into a big loop, and the loop takes you around to backlot sets themed to real places using real backlot set technology. I mean, these are not forced perspective buildings. Yeah. These are very accurate, could be used for any television and movie. They were designed by the best guys who did that sort of stuff in Hollywood. They spared no expense on that backlot sets, too. That is one of the places there was no scrimping and saving, because Wasserman felt that if it was going to be used for productions, it had to be done at the best possible way. And then each of the areas, the ride was themed to that area. So when you're in New York, of course, it's King Kong. If you're in San Francisco, it's Earthquake. When you're in Amityville, you're going to have Jaws. So each of the rides, you're sort of the World's Fair area before it was the World's Fair area. That's why you had E.T., that stuff that didn't really fit together kind of was sort of shoved over there. And so so you were going to walk through the back lot and then ride the movie, which was a concept that really came about as early as 74, when they came up with the collapsing bridge in Hollywood. That was the first time when Terry Winnick did that and the guys were standing on it. That's the first time they realized you're writing the movie, because that was done by a drunken brainstorming session where they were playing with little models of the tram, and they were figuring everything they could do with the tram. We could drop it. We could swing it. We could throw it up into space. We could twist it all around. And so what else could we do with the tram? So, you know, we could ride the movie. We could put people right in that movie. So that's the other thing. And then the other thing they figured out, if we're going to do this and we're going to go head to head to Disney, we have to go bigger and better. So think about it. Universal Studios Florida, when it first opened, had really no B or C ticket rides. Everything was E tickets. These were all big, big rides. They were all designed to have huge throughputs. They wanted to make sure that you never had to wait in a line more than 45 minutes for any of their big blockbuster rides. Here's something that you'll really notice the difference. Look at the bathrooms. Look at the bathrooms at Universal versus the bathrooms at Disney. They had a team of guys go out and count how many stalls and make sure they had at least 25% more stalls in every Universal bathroom. Their bathrooms are huge. You could put an entire city in a bathroom at Universal compared to what you can at Disney by design. They studied the hot dogs over at Disney and made sure that the Universal hot dogs were fatter and a little bit longer. So there were that sort of thing, and all the ride mechanisms were never before tried super ride mechanisms. So you were flying with E.T. over, I guess it's San Francisco or some city that's like that. Some wonderful. It's not Peter Pan, but it's a bigger Peter Pan. And you know, King Kong was a giant robot who shook you and then threw you down. And there was a little teeny tiny tram tour for the first few years, but it was just a little short thing. But you got to see real television being made with Nickelodeon, unlike what you saw at Disney. And on Disney's tour, although it went on forever, most of the time you were looking down in sound stages that were empty. They were really staged for the tourists. Because Hollywood, first of all, wasn't excited about coming out to Florida anyways, and they really weren't excited about having their productions and people looking down into their productions. Disney had to build sound stages that were designed just to attract some Hollywood productions, since the Hollywood didn't want to use any of the sound stages they had there. So that was where the genesis of it was. It was, once again, sheer panic. Oh, my God, Disney's going to do this. What can we do that's different, that's still based on our heritage and based on Jay Stein's J-Bangs? Look at every single ride at Universal Studios Florida Initiation. Every ride had some sort of a J-Bang. And we could probably all name them together, can't we? You know, when you see the big cityscape in E.T., don't you even today still go, Jaws, whether they were blowing him up and blood bits were flying, or they were blowing him up and he blew up, moment where the very first Jaws version where he grabbed the front of the boat and spun you around, that kind of thing. You know, those were J-Bangs. Those are when King Kong lifts you up and he's holding you. That's a J-Bang. So that defined the Universal experience. It was different than the Disney experience.
Yeah. Not much to add after that.
Sorry, guys, up on your format. I hope not.
not at all. I just need to figure out where we're gonna go after this now. Oh man, I guess one of the good quotes I want to bring from your book real quick is from David Snarnoff saying, "Competition brings out the worst in people and the best in products."
Yeah, well, that's been the case, and that's the other thing too. It's the premise of this book is it's personal, and it was originally, and then the whole Eisner versus Universal thing, that was really personal, and the book highlights that. And even today, it really is personal. You know, Comcast, fine company. The guy who runs the division is Steve Burke, very very talented guy. He basically saved Disneyland Paris. He got the Disney store started. Brilliant guy, should have probably been running the theme parks, most certainly should have been running the Disney theme parks instead of Paul Pressler, because he got passed over by Paul Pressler, by Michael Eisner. He just figured, these people are stupid. And so he goes, that's my quote, that's not Steve Burke, I'm sure that's more intelligent about it. But he left, he worked for Comcast, who is a great company, dynamic company, and they tried to buy Disney, as you know. And at the time, Eisner's biggest complaint about Comcast is they would sell off or dismantle the theme parks. They don't understand them, which ultimately was really insulting Steve Burke, because he understood the parks better generally than most of the people who were running the parks over at Disney at the time. And ultimately, they got to buy Universal relatively cheap. General Electric didn't want it anymore. They bought not only the Universal parks, but they bought the Universal parks with a deal for the Harry Potter stuff. So that was a pretty good, sweet little deal as well, too. And Burke understood what it really takes to get theme parks going, and invested a lot of money to get kickstart Universal Florida, and he certainly did that. And they're spending a lot of money in Hollywood, and Hollywood is going to be a much different place next summer than it is this year. It's going to be a very different experience by next year. It's remarkable. And Comcast does seem to be pretty committed to investing in their parks. They understand the cash flow benefits of it. And there's a little bit of the because if you think about it right now, I mean, how many Disney rides have we been cheering in the last 4 years, and how many things that Universal's been doing that we've been cheering? I leave that question to you two.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's totally true. A lot of Universal, not many Disney. Yeah. I mean, and you brought up a good point with Steve Burke is, I remember I was in high school, not to make it seem that long ago, when the takeover news of Comcast and Disney came up, and people were talking about, oh, Comcast wants this for ESPN, and everything else will be spun out. Which, you know, maybe partially true, but that was also the truth with when they took over Universal. When Comcast took over, they were like, we're going to look at the theme parks, we may spin it off, I don't know. This is still when Blackstone owned like 49 or 51% of them or something.
Yeah.
And, we don't know what's going on, and they wanted them for NBC, but then they started buying out all of Blackstone, and Blackstone, which is the leech of the theme park industry, if not more, which may be saying quite a lot compared to Disney, right, at this point in time.
How do you really feel about them?
Yeah.
No, you know, that's the other thing, too, that's funny about Universal, the story, which was made the book both very I think it's an interesting read, but also it was a very very difficult book to research because they've gone through so many owners. So it's like MCA. Well, MCA invent. They love the tour. And then they got the theme parks going. Then you go from what? We go from MCA to Masuda. So you got the Japanese. They don't even know what the hell's going on with it. They just want to buy software to go inside of their electronics, and they weren't like really handicapping it, but they weren't spending much money either. Then it goes to what? Then it goes Seagram's. To Seagram. Seagram, oh, well, Edgar Bonfim Jr. wants to be Walt Disney, doesn't he now? And he spends a lot of money and doesn't realize anything about cash flow. But at least gets Islands of Adventure started and lovingly spends a bunch of money on the company. Then he gets out Vivendi, a sewer company from France, who just sucks the life out of it. You just think it's the worst thing possible until GE buys them. And then GE comes in and Bob Reif, the chairman, comes into their office and says, going, what are you doing? Running a 501? See here, you know, this is a nonprofit organization, and they didn't care at all. But everybody who bought it ultimately wanted to get rid of the theme park business until they saw the cash flow. And they thought, you know, good times or bad times, money's coming in out and in the door and out the door. And if it wasn't for Halloween Haunt in Florida, which really made the money for the rest of the year, that kept Universal Studios Florida alive in the 90s. It's not the Disney story, which is, for the most part, one can paint it as sweet, and we want to create wonderful places. The Universal story is, let's make money by scaring people to death. And then nowadays, by just seeing what the competition is and realizing if the competition wants to be lame, we don't also have to be lame. We could just do what Walt Disney did, which was to hire set designers to build sets that people can then go walk through, and they can go on their own stories within characters they love and adore. And if we have to squeeze them in a teeny tiny store that they have to line up in front of, in the real world, that sucks. But you know what? I'd rather have a store that has a big line out front of it, because when that person gets in that store, they're damn well going to buy something now, aren't they? and that was Universal's approach. Whenever they've had a strong property owner like the Harry Potter and Warner's and Rowling, with same thing with 20th Century Fox with The Simpsons, and then when they own it themselves, like the stuff with the Minions, they tend to sort of still get it kind of right, but there's still enough half-assed stuff about it. And that's because they don't have an intellectual property licensee who quite keeps their feet to the fire. They still need to gain that kind of confidence. But they may do that. We'll see here.
Yeah.
We'll see what the things that are building now.
I totally agree with you. They need to kind of build up with. I mean, when you look at Transformers to Despicable Me, and they still have that really crazy ass nothing queue behind the facade. You're like, yeah. Come on, guys, come on, do something there. It's a house, for crying out loud. It's not that. You know, enclose it and put some walls up and some plaster. You know, it's not that hard.
I note in the book that, you know, this is once again the short-term short-term memory of corporations. But in the latest press releases for Minion Mayhem up in Universal Studios Hollywood, they talk about the first Universal ride with an immersive environment facade, because it has little stand-up houses. You ring the doorbells and you hear Minions yelling from behind the doors. But to get to Minion Mayhem, you have to walk through, I think it was 1989, the Streets of the World sets, which were basically backlot sets built upstairs that you had to walk through that were completely immersive environments. So it's like, maybe the press agent should have left the 5511 building backstage to walk to Minion Mayhem before they wrote that sentence, and they'd realize that maybe it was an add to the Streets of the World and not so. But that's
an expansion of our first. Yes. An expansion to the world's first fully themed area of a theme park.
But to get to that, you have to walk through a fully immersive area of the theme park. So
yeah.
go figure.
Yeah, just bizarre. Do you want One of the weird parts of Universal Studios Florida was Jaws, the original version of the ride, and kind of everything that happened with it, with the rebuilding, the lawsuits. Basically, Jaws opened, and it had a bunch of complex effects, including Jaws grabbing your boat, turning it around, and then the giant explosion, which was a bunch of shark parts and dye. And then it never worked for the whole summer, and then it went down for 2 years for reconstruction and lawsuits and all sorts of fun stuff.
Yeah, Peter Alexander, who's one of the guys who helped develop the ride, said that in his entire time of developing it, he may have ridden it a half a dozen times where all the effects work. And the shark bits one is one I really wish I could have experienced as it worked, because the idea is that, you know, they shoot like a grenade launcher, the shark blows up, and little bits of shark body fly up in the air. And they get sucked into like a drain and get reprocessed, and then they blow up again a few minutes later.
Have you seen the Martins video of this?
I have. I've seen videos, but it's one of those things. I think you had to kind of really be there. It was a brilliant idea, but what they did is the company that they hired, who also worked on other attractions there, and they were well-meaning guys, they were testing the product, they were testing the stuff, and they would test them for months, but they were testing them in underwater, and they didn't test them long enough or use the right kind of stress testing on them. So what happened is all the components that were complex and going under, because at times the shark would actually swim underneath the boat, it was very complicated, the parts just wore out. And they just finally, it was such an embarrassment. On the grand opening day. This is, you know, Steven Spielberg, who is a huge reason why they got into the theme park business. I was mentioning earlier is the competition of Disney. It wasn't just the competition of Disney. It was the competition between George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. When George Lucas drags Steven Spielberg to see Star Tours in its development and said, oh, you're with the wrong studio. You should have come over to Disney. Look at the kind of stuff they do. And then Jay Stein had heard about this and hinted that maybe Spielberg should go in and see Bob Gurr and Peter Alexander programming the head for King Kong. And Spielberg went, oh, I didn't know you guys can do this kind of stuff. I want a ride for Back to the Future. And when Steven Spielberg wants to start building rides, Lou Wasserman and Sidney Sheinberg of MCA are like, yeah, how much money do you need? So Spielberg got interested in doing rides. All of a sudden, the theme park, the MCA got interested in doing rides. So that's a long ways to the shark thing. It just didn't work. And they just gave up on it. And they had to re-engineer it, redo, configure the story. There was lots of lawsuits. Settlements were made. The book gets into a lot of that detail. The ride's a very different experience the second time around than it was the first time around, but it was fairly reliable. Ultimately, what doomed it was intellectual property of Harry Potter, and it was also very expensive to run because it used a lot of gas in the final explosions and stuff. But it was another ultimate J-Bang ride. If you think about it, you'd go around and you'd get the big scare when you were in the building. You'd get the climatic big scare. You'd get the first time the guide freaks out, and it also sort of harks back to the old tour, because that was an experience where if you were on it and you had a really good tour guide, I bet it's probably one of the best rides you'd ever been on, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, tour guides make it, really.
Yeah. It was a great ride.
Yeah, if the tour guide was really believing it and having fun with you, it was just remarkable. But ultimately, it was ultimately the gas cost. I think that ultimately doomed it. It kind of suggested, here's a lot of land that we have, and look how much money we can save. But then what is it? It's up going through the dragon now, isn't it? So how much? Oh no, they're going to close down Harry Potter because of the cost of the gas of the dragon.
In all fairness, the dragon doesn't go off every like 30 seconds or 90 seconds. It's every 12 minutes.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to go on to the next topic. What are you going to say?
Please do. No. Go on.
Okay, let's move on. I actually want to cover this real quick. A quote from your book: Peter Alexander recalled a moment at the grand opening of Back to the Future, when he saw Spielberg and George Lucas exit the attraction. Quote unquote, George looked furious while Spielberg was grinning ear to ear. Thumbs up all the way, baby.
Yes, yes. And I have, I'm paranoid about Universal as a company, so that's why there's no photos in the book. But all the wonderful guys who helped with the book, they sent me different photos, and I have a photo of the Back to the Future crowd with Barry Upson and Peter Alexander and the rest of the crew who worked on that, and George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. It really was the thing that it was that competition between those two directors as well that helped fuel at least the opportunity for Universal to get into the ride game. And if you think about it, they stop. Those are real rides. They're not demonstrations. You're not going through an effect, getting a laugh, and then they're resetting the effect. These are, you're experiencing the movie. Jaws was not, we're going to show you how the Jaws works. Like it was in Hollywood, Jaws was, you were now writing the movie. You were there. Your life is in the hands of your tour guide, that kind of thing.
Yeah. And also, really quick touch on the Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Studios Florida, kind of how that started. Another quote from your book is, anyone in this business tries to find a new niche where the competition is less intense. For us, this is Halloween.
Yeah, it was really important to Hollywood. I mean, it was the idea, of course, was copied from Knott's Scary Farm, which John Waite and others had created many, many years before in Knott's Berry Farm. And when they were in Hollywood, they figured, well, you know, Jay Stein, who was really a huge fan of the Universal Monsters, he came up with a show called Castle Dracula. He loved celebrating the Universal Monsters, Dracula and Frankenstein and the rest of the Wolfman and Creature from the Black Lagoon. And this was an opportunity, if there was ever a studio, if there was ever a place that should be able to pull off a scary kind of show, it certainly should be Universal. So very early on, you know, October was a really slow month at Universal Studios Florida. They decided to try it, and it worked really well. And my impression, because I went back to it while writing the book, is it is very much like the Knott's Scary Farm, where you get multiple generations, dad and the kid, mom and the daughter, or the son, are going and they're experiencing it and they're sharing an experience. That's very much like the Knott's Scary Farm one, which is, it's the continuing of the church because it's been there for, what, 24 years or something like that?
Yep, 25 years next year.
And it's grown into a huge thing. I am awestruck with the fact that in Florida they still sell liquor, and Hollywood, of course, they don't. I just don't understand that. But it does take over the park. It's a huge moneymaker. I think that the one in Florida is really quite special because it's got both the balance. It takes advantage of the fact they have real sound stages, and they can put mazes in the real sound stages, and they can take the stuff and they can put the stuff because of the amount of land off stage, and so they can let the backlot sets really function very well as scary places. So, and this is from a guy who generally hates Halloween haunt type of stuff. I was really impressed with the Florida one, and it was very important, and it saved the park many years, and also a lot of locals' discounts. Locals got into the habit of going, especially like Disney employees, going over to Universal because it was pretty cheap. They sold alcohol. They would go to, I think it was Mulligan's, they'd go to the bar there, they'd have a beer or something, and it became more of a locals' hangout for people who were in the theme park industry, and that also was very beneficial too.
Yeah, that's something I got a lot too, is that this was a locals haunt even up till Harry Potter opened. You know, it was a very local kind of area. And also this year, along with Nick, was our first year to Halloween Horror Nights. So yeah. I totally understand that, being like someone who's not a huge fan of the Halloween. I like Halloween. I don't like the haunt kind of aspect of it, but it is a completely unique and really cool thing. And not to rub it into the whole entire Hollywood aesthetic, but there is something nice about getting a Duff beer and then going to see Bill and Ted.
Yeah, just going. I have to confess, guys, just going to see Bill and Ted, because they didn't run that this year in Hollywood. They ran it and had to stop it halfway through. So
yeah,
that's a whole other topic, and I don't want to get into that one.
Yeah, you saw Bill and Ted this year at Orlando, right?
I didn't go for Halloween this year. I went the one year that I had to do research on it. I really genuinely just dislike those things. They're places I don't want to be. I'm no fun at these Halloween haunts. I'm usually going up to the little monster guy that's trying to scare me. I'm going, I hope you get a break soon. Yeah. You know, that kind of thing. So I'm not really good at those. So I'm sorry.
Oh, that's fine.
Well, we all all of our limitations, but I did like the one, and I really liked I liked being able to go into real sound stages, and it was a good excuse to be able to peek backstage at the old Nickelodeon studios and that area where they have all the plaques of all the productions.
I saw that and I was freaking out.
Yeah, if nothing else, that was worth it to me, and it gave me kind of a better sense of the place, because it's not like I would actually go backstage of any theme park that I write about, because that would be improper now, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would be. Don't do that, guys. Right. And don't take photos over walls.
That's right. Or they'll attack you and stick you with the creature of the Black Lagoon. Yeah, all right. Okay. Yeah. Questions.
Yeah. Moving on a little bit real quick. One note you also had was that MCA was actually making a dent in the Disney crowds, and that reportedly some of the people who were doing park estimates were pulling a few million visitors off of Epcot to put on the studios to say that was ahead. And it was this kind of, you know, like kind of fudgy thing where it's like, well, these aren't official, you know, attendance estimates. These are released through THEA, the Theme Park Entertainment Association. You know, so it's like a little bit unofficial, but they get them from people who hear it from people and they talk about things. So it's kind of like a wink, wink, nudge, nudge sort of situation. So I always kind of found that was interesting, and especially now that, you know, wow, Disney raised their attendance 3%. For the sixth year in a row. How miraculous is that?
Yeah, it's true. You know, they try to take the best estimates, but ultimately, especially at the time, Disney sort of got the last word. And when they would do, the researchers would contact me. Well, this is what we're estimating. Yeah, that's about right. And Disney was able to sort of move their numbers around. And I was hesitant at first to write that, except for I found more than three sources for that same information. And so I started to really believe it. And even today, it does sort of outstand. It does sort of boggle me. I'm finding it harder and harder to believe that, like, Animal Kingdom is drawing more people than Hollywood Studios is drawing more people than Islands of Adventure right now. For instance, it may be the case, but it doesn't feel really right. And it really, for Disney, it is an issue. It will become an issue, because as long as they dominate the top four slots in Florida, they're okay. But the moment Universal has one project that moves up there, that will get so many tongues wagging that doesn't really benefit Disney. And so I think that's all of a sudden why you're seeing Disney going, oh, let's spend a little bit of money on the Hollywood Studios and Animal Kingdom just to make sure that they don't get nipped at the end there.
Yeah, and a good point was you know, Hollywood Studios can't do it. Well, that's because if you actually look at the capacity of the park day over day, many days, they probably should have a few fire marshals there, like shutting down the park because it's running against capacity. Like, that's the kind of numbers they're saying they're doing is like, like illegal.
Oh, no, it's legal because they're all on the tram tour.
Oh, okay, of course, yes, of course,
and the tram tour has a high capacity. Oh, wait, the tram tour is closed now. That doesn't work.
Yeah, well,
I don't know, but I'm more of a historian as opposed to a speculator, so I'll leave the speculation to others.
That's fair enough. And that's a really good point also with Jim Hill bringing up, you know, like, Disney's trying to rewrite a lot of history right now, saying, oh, well, it's the Frozen celebration has brought people to the parks, and it just shows you how if we actually spend money, it's so great, and as opposed to, oh my god, Diagon Alley, what are we gonna do, you know, that kind of thing. So it's a little bit of rewriting history and trying to, you know, move things around right now. Even listening to Len and Jim talk, there we go. You know, it's that kind of thing where, you know, there's the official Disney spin of, well, you know, Frozen has brought so many people to this park and it's so great and we're really seeing the investment right now, versus then, you know, like 5 minutes later, he's just immediately talking like, yeah, Diagon Alley is dragging everyone out. You know, you just hear this official Disney line and then this sort of bottom, not necessarily bottom tier, but this, like, this is what's actually happening kind of story behind the veil thing.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, as theme park fans that are a little bit more dispassionate about it, we kind of look and compare. I'm not going to argue on the numbers and stuff like that, because once again, that's Jim does speculation. I don't do speculation.
Yes.
I just look at history and trends and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
The reality of it is that what Universal has done, and this is notable, is they've added a tremendous amount of capacity, physical capacity to their parks, very, very very, very quickly at the same time. Hang on, here's I'm surprising with this.
There we go. 1 hour in, we're good. I got you. I'm vamping. Yeah. There we go.
All right. That you know, you have to sort of look at it in a pragmatic sort of way. And the fact is that Universal Studios, especially lately Universal Studios Florida, has added a tremendous amount of capacity to their parks by adding Transformers, which is a high-capacity ride with a very thick queue, and Diagon Alley, another high-capacity ride when it works, with a very thick queue. And just in a running the number sense, how many bodies can you shove within the gates? And then how many of those bodies can you take off the sidewalks and put them someplace else so that you can shove more bodies in? That's the sort of way that Walt Disney designed Disneyland and the way the Imagineers designed the early Disney theme parks. That is exactly the way that Comcast is running their parks. While Disney is trying to, with Magic Band, be able to maximize capacity without necessarily adding anything by using the Magic Band to move people around at their convenience to have maximum capacity. Or a way of looking at it is look at a glass of water that's, let's say, two-thirds full. What Disney's trying to do is it's trying to make sure that they can keep filling up that until it's at the very, very top of the glass. Universal's pouring water in there, but at the same time, they're just bringing another glass over and going to start filling that up by this continual building. It does give them the ability to attract more people and have places to put people. They're also doing that with the aggressive building of hotel rooms, the purchase of new properties that they're going to be able to take advantage of that. And Disney, you know, at some point they're going to have to loosen the belt as well. And I suppose that they're doing that with Avatar and a few other things, but that hasn't been the way they've been operating over the last few years, and that has been the way that Comcast has been running the Universal Park. So it's very, very different that way.
And that's a really good comment you brought up about increasing capacity, because in 1994, when they closed down 20,000 Leagues, they lost a lot of capacity, and when Universal shut down Jaws, they lost a little bit less capacity, but the idea that New Fantasyland went in over a giant water feature that's one ride, and Diagon Alley went over one giant attraction that was a water ride-ish.
Actually, I would disagree with you on that. I would disagree with part of the premise, which is that 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea maybe have had 8 to 1,200 people per hour. It actually had pretty crappy...
it did? Okay.
And Jaws, because it was a universal ride, I don't know the number off the top of my head, but it should have been close to like 2,000 an hour or something like that. All the universal rides were basically giant e-tickets with huge capacities.
Okay.
They didn't, up until recently, they haven't done anything like spinners and stuff like that, the little itty bitty rides. That was, they kind of left that to Disney.
Yeah.
But it is true that they have you know, think of it, they've added Transformers alone, you know, was a brilliant move because it used technology they already had that was proven. They were able to build it in Hollywood. It was a big success. It was a very successful franchise. They basically took the same blueprint for the ride, slightly different queue, and opened it in a remarkable 12 months. And, you know, that's a couple thousand people an hour that can go through that didn't have something else, and it's a draw on its own. And if you think of it, Diagon Alley gets really crowded, but thank you very much for having Transformers just outside of it. That's now starting to suck up a lot more of the people as well, too.
Yeah.
And then even Diagon Alley, I think, you know, things like when you go into Nocturne Alley is to me like one of the coolest things in a theme park. I bought one of those wands, an elder wand, of course. You know, I actually got to go to the experience once and had a wand pick me. But the one playing all the little light, you know, and getting all the things going. And I spent an entire half a day just with a beer in my hand and making stuff go off. And it was like, this is great.
No, that is the best thing in the world.
So it's like, this is better than taking a card at Disney and standing in front of a big television screen that's shaped like a mirror and getting it to do something. I'm making magic. I'm dancing with the gorilla skeleton.
I'm getting people wet because I'm taking a water, you know, drinking fountain and it's spitting water behind me, or I'm making these people who are sitting underneath this umbrella, you know, get wet, all that stuff, you know.
Glad you clarified that. Yeah. All right.
Exactly. But right. I guess my comment was just generally that you know, Disney spent 19 years trying to replace the capacity of 20,000 Leagues, while Universal took 18 months to do it.
I think the mine train is a good example. How many decades does it take to build that?
And
at the same time, you've got a hotel, Transformers, and Diagon Alley, and that train, and rebuilding Islands of Adventure along with all that.
And Despicable Me, and redoing Spider-Man, and you got the new Blue Man Show, which is a totally different creative team, I understand. But I mean, you're adding, and you have the new parade. You have Cine Spectacular,
and Cowfish, new restaurant.
Hey, Cowfish, Antojitos. You have Vivo. Yep. You have all that stuff.
Hot dog, whatever.
Actually, the original idea of Cowfish sounded really disgusting to me, but what you described sounded really good.
Well,
it's awesome.
Is it? Okay, all right. I'll have to get that next time I'm out there.
The idea behind
it's basically got three menus. You have the sushi menu, you have the burger menu, then you have the combination menu. So
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm shuddering, guys. On that note, so give me a couple of final more questions here.
Okay, let's move over to Islands of Adventure.
Yes. Park.
So I guess one of the things that – it kind of started out as Cartoon World.
That's right.
And it started out trying to, create a bunch of properties, finding out that in Hollywood and also in various other places around the country that there were these quote-unquote kiddie parks that were starting up that would add, several hundred thousand people. You quoted Sesame Place, my former employer, in Pennsylvania, in Bucks County.
I got that. Okay, good.
Yes, you did. It was perfect. And a bunch of other places like that, and then kind of how that kind of morphed into the Islands of Adventure concept, and how also they added Jurassic Park and that catalyst.
Yeah, it was really kind of very interesting. They were always looking to expand a little bit, and both for Hollywood and Florida, they wanted to create something, whether it would be like Sesame Place or Camp Snoopy at Knott's Berry Farm as an internal park, or something like Legoland. They were exploring that. Didn't have really enough room to do it in Hollywood at the end of the day, but in Florida, it made some sense. They started putting together, and Jay Stein thought kind of if Universal Studios Florida was about cinema and television, that something of celebrating the written word would be kind of fun. And it would be more of a real fantasy park. He always thought that ultimately Universal Studios Florida was like Hollywood. It was an industrial tour. And he wanted to create a fantasy park. And he brought together his early designers and stuck up on the wall a map of Disneyland and said, I want to build one of these. And they did a lot of study. And they wanted to do the same sort of a park that was based on fantasies. And so the properties that they were lining up, that they were trying to pitch for was with Warner Brothers would be Looney Tunes and the DC Comics superheroes. They were looking at King's Feature Syndicate, which ultimately did become Toon Lagoon, with Popeye rides and stuff like that. They were in early talks with Dr. Seuss. That was a tremendous story that they had. And then they were going to build this theme park around these different properties. And some of the stuff was just fabulous that goes on in the book. We talk about for instance, Gary Goddard had worked on the Marvel Superhero Island. No, not Marvel Superhero Island. The Superhero Island with DC Comics. You would have had a Batman versus Penguin dueling roller coaster ride that went through three show buildings. You would have had in the Looney Tunes area a roller coaster dark ride that was Marvin the Martian chasing you around like you were in Space Mountain. And another one that was Yosemite Sam, and you're on little horses in a 360 movie, and then the cartoon characters going, oh, he went that away, and all of a sudden your little horse would turn around and you would go start going the other way.
That'd be awesome.
Things that were like that, that were based on DC Comics and Looney Tunes. And they tried to doing this, and they were in negotiations with Warner Brothers for the license. And Universal offered one amount, and Warner's another one, and they kept getting closer and closer. But they just couldn't quite close the deal. And when that deal didn't happen, all of a sudden, Cartoon World was dead. They kind of resuscitated a little bit by getting Marvel, because at the time, Marvel was sucking wind, and they were really pretty cheap to buy off. So they got Marvel very, very cheaply, so that kind of helped. And they got Morris King Syndicate, and then then Steven Spielberg, of course, the big tail is wagging the dog, wanted to do something with Jurassic Park. They did a study for a ride at Universal Studios Florida, and I go into detail on that in the book. And also for Hollywood, and ultimately it was the concept, the intellectual property of Jurassic Park, they decided to build the park around Jurassic Park. And then everything else was there really to ultimately supplement Jurassic Park. So it was the primary ride. It was the big show building is across the lagoon. So that's the show building that tries to walk you all the way around it. Marvel Superhero Island were some of the remains of the DC comic book land, but not much of it. Toon Lagoon was a sort of morphing of rides. Lost Continent was added really as just in a sense to sort of not be so cartoon heavy. And then the Dr. Seuss area was an area that was very, very near and dear to the heart of those designers. And of course, they knocked that one out of the park with a tremendous little land. And then the whole entry pavilion thing was designed with Islands of Adventure to be a port of entry and to sort of take you out of the regular world and put you into another world with little links to all the other islands. And it was really designed to go head-to-head with the Disney fantasy theme park, and in many ways very successful. Some ways a little bit light. Marketing didn't help it any, but I love it. It's my second favorite theme park in the U.S. behind Disneyland.
Well, I think we'd say USF right now is probably my second favorite behind Disneyland. Just because Diagon Alley, but, you know, whatever. Anyway, that's all opinion.
It is. You know, what's really special to me, and Phil Hedema, who wrote the foreword to the Universal versus Disney book, was the principal designer for Islands of Adventure, so I'm both honored to have him as the guy to write the foreword, and I sure did learn a lot about it because of that as well, too. And it works. That if you really think about it, Islands of Adventure, it started in 1999, has not really changed significantly. The concept has held up really quite well. And one thing that Islands of Adventure has that I still think is really at a premium at parks is it has space. He kind of commented to me that it was the peninsulas of adventure, and the fact that each of the lands have little fingers that go out into the lagoon that even on the busiest days you can go and you can find a little place to have some space, mm-hmm. to be immersed in one theme and then have a vista of something really remarkable on the other side. And Disney's carving up and getting rid of all those spaces. Islands of Adventure really celebrates that. Yeah. So
Disney's turning them into premium dessert party experiences. And right. Universal, you know, they have the ones behind the Discovery Center or near Mythos or, you know, all those locations. Toon Lagoon has the ones by Popeyes, all those kinds of locations.
And that's what a theme park should have. It should have the ability to have to be immersed in it all, but also to be a part of it somewhat. And Islands of Adventure is weirdly enough becoming one of the few parks that still have that. And I don't think they can get rid of that very easily either. That infrastructure is kind of there, and it'd be hard to repurpose it. So
yeah, we'll see. Totally. And another comment I wanted to bring up was you mentioned something that actually. That Sean mentioned to me when I was at Islands of Adventure. I didn't know for the first time, but the first structure built at Islands Adventure was the Zax statue. So they literally built the story of the Zax is that, you know, the north and the southbound Zax, and they would not move for each other, and the city was built around them. And the first structure built at Islands Adventure, any of Islands Adventure, was the Zax statue, and the whole park was built around these guys, which I think is just awesome and brilliant. And I've heard there's photos of it, but I've not seen photos.
There's also another kind of really hidden thing that I never picked up, and then Phil mentioned it to me, and that is if you're over at the Camp Jurassic, right? Camp Jurassic, the playground over in the Jurassic Park area, and which I think is just an absolutely stupendous playland area, and it's built around a cauldron. And if you look carefully, the cauldron has a spiral. The spiral carries out throughout the Jurassic Park land, including the ride. So it also has an integrity based around a central element. And, of course, I think most people recognize Marvel Superhero Island also has what looks like a meteor crash. And everything is a blast out of that particular meteor crash. So there's a logic. There's a real logic built in, which as an urban planner, it's what I really like about Disneyland that Islands of Adventure has that's very, very special and still retains it today, even after the changes.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm trying to go through the book a little bit right now on my Kindle.
Do it fast because I need to get going.
Okay, right. Yes. Sorry. Do you want to close real quick with any like last comments about Harry Potter and those editions? Because we're running a little late, so sorry about that.
Oh, no, not a problem. No, the Harry Potter thing was really interesting. You know, I know there was lots and lots of rumors that people have talked about competition between Disney and MCA. At one point, Phil Hedema had put together, this is before the first Harry Potter film, had put together a stage show concept based kind of on the same sort of stuff that they were doing for Conan the Barbarian, and pitched that to J.K. Rowling's and Warner before the first movie, and J.K. Rowling wasn't really interested at the time, and it didn't really go anywhere. So Universal had been very interested in the Harry Potter characters early on. What ultimately ended up happening was just it was fortuitous for Universal. General Electric really could care less about the parks. Warner really, really wanted somebody to pick up on this. J.K. Rowling was sort of, you know, I'll do it if it can have all the control in the world, and they do it really right, but I don't really want to do this otherwise, unless it's done right. So General Electric had nothing to lose. They just basically signed a deal that gave Warner everything. I mean, they make a bunch of money on the thing, on the royalties, an extraordinary deal on the royalties. They have complete control. But the most important thing is that they set down the rule that Stuart Craig, who is the set designer for the first four Harry Potter films, had to be the designer for the Universal area, the principal designer, and had basically the final say. J.K. Rowling had ultimately the final say. But because of that, what ultimately happened is that they basically mimicked what Walt Disney did at Disneyland, which was Walt didn't hire architects to design Disneyland. He hired set designers to design Disneyland, which is why they function well as a set. They may not necessarily function well as a piece of urban planning, but that's what you're going to a theme park for, is that experience. And so by Universal not designing it per se, but being really pushed through a very clear vision, they stood up to the challenge, and they did brilliant work, and they created something very, very magical with Hogsmeade and Hogwarts Castle and stuff. And it paid off, and the deal was great, and they've really done that well with Diagon Alley, and I think that the ride there is stupendous, but I believe the game changer for all of it is that train being able to connect the two parks in that way. To me, that is absolutely the coolest thing, is the way that train now, all of a sudden, when you're buying a ticket for Universal, you don't even think of them as two parks anymore. You're going to buy the ticket to take you to both sides anyways. And they've been able to overcome that hesitancy of $100 a park ticket, because you don't even thinking about buying a one park ticket. You're going to buy it for two parks anyways. Because are you going to tell your kid you can't go on the train? It's great.
The real game changer is the fact that I can buy a beer in the queue line and take it on the ride with me.
And you know, that's the other thing too lately. I'll make this my last comment about the queue competition, is that the food has been getting really good at Universal lately versus what Disney's been having. I've been very let down, but you know, I've got to say at Universal, that Krusty Burger's not bad, and Mythos is still really quite good, and the food in general if Disney's got to be nervous about anything, in my opinion, it's the fact that I can go have a Duff beer, watch a kid get fascinated with a Flaming Moe, eat a clogger while watching a cartoon on the television showing what it's doing to my heart, and then gushing it down with a beer over on the Harry Potter side of it. Not that I drink all that much, but it's good beer. It's actually really quite
good. Yes, it is. It is very really good beer.
The product is good. So this has been delightful, you guys. I appreciate it. This is the first interview with regard to the Universal book that I've done so far. So I thank you for dredging up all those memories. a year plus of research and stuff. I think this has been great.
Yes, I remember Len mentioning to us last year you're writing a book, and we got really excited about that. So thank you for joining us. Sorry for keeping you for a half hour longer than we asked.
No, that's fine. Just send me all the links and stuff like that, and I'll get it up on our social media. And make sure you have to force Len to make sure that he links to this as well, too.
I definitely will. Where can we find you on the internets or in social medias?
There's the Sam Genoway page on Facebook.
Okay.
And that's probably the best place to go.
Okay, I'll link that and I'll have to friend that or whatever, or like it or whatever you do on Facebook nowadays. Nick, where can we find you on Twitter?
Parkscope Nick on Twitter.
You can find me at Parkscope Joe on Twitter. You can find us all at parkscope.net. I will link the book, Sam Genoway's page on Facebook, all that fun stuff on our site. Again, thank you, Sam. You have no idea. It's been an absolute honor and a blast. I wish this could last for like 10 hours.
Thanks.
I feel like we could just do this like a cowfish for like, you know, ever. Because
well,
you know,
if you're buying, I'll happily join you for that.
So what I'm saying though is that I'll buy a round of table made guac and margaritas at Antojitos.
It's
pretty good, right, Nick?
It's the best. I don't eat guac, and I eat that guac. So there you go.
It's pretty good. So thank you very much. We'll see you guys later, and Kungaloosh.